Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Phil Hayes Show.
Hello there. Welcome to the show. The Phil Hayes Show is brought to you by The Athletic and The Square Ball. My name's Dan Moylan. Hello. From The Athletic is Phil Hay.
Hello.
And from The Square Ball, Michael Normanson.
Hello.
We're going to be chatting about Cess Pod shortly, Leeds United's former community officer. Phil spoke to Cess as part of The Athletic marking Black History Month. Very informative then, Phil.
A fascinating guy. I mean, obviously no playing connection with Leeds United, but grew up in the city and came back as the community football officer at a really key point at the end of the 80s and 1990s when the club were kind of stepping up the fight against racism, and a fascinating chat with a very intelligent guy.
Yeah, the accompanying article is an absolute must read, and for a limited time you can get that and get The Athletic for just £1 a month, including that look at Rafinha that we mentioned last week and a piece on the transformation of Leeds United and Wolves as football clubs. To read all that, head to theathletic.com/leadspod to sign up. That's theathletic.com/leadspod. Get yourself signed up for £1 a month. With reference to Wolves then, Phil, we weren't quite sure what to expect when we previewed that last week. Could have gone either way, and it went, well, the wrong way.
And could have gone either way on Monday, the way the game panned out. They say that you get away with less in the Premier League, and I think we saw that on Monday evening, that there wasn't a huge amount wrong with Leeds' performance, I didn't think, but there was a lot in the game that will have reminded you of the harder Championship matches last season and the season before, where Leeds had a lot of the ball in the more dominant periods, but really struggled to dig out that killer chance that they needed, and found it difficult against a team who were really well structured and really well organised, and actually seemed to realise in the first half that it made sense to sit deep and try and draw the sting out of Leeds. And you just got that feeling in the second half that Wolves realised that they'd maybe just come through that little storm, and that they had the fluency and the quality in their team to pick Leeds off and to get something from the game. And I thought in particular the last 20 minutes after Wolves scored, the way in which they knew how to see the game out, the way in which they understood how to manage it and to make sure that Leeds were able to create very little in that closing period, I think underlines the fact that they are a Europa League team, very high quality team, and have been for the past two seasons in the Premier League, and not a performance or a game to panic about at all, but the sort of thing that is going to happen in this division.
Both Stuart Dallas and Nuno Santo said it was a game of fine margins. Do you think it just swung on that little bit of extra quality that Wolves were able to find? It felt like they were able to just notch it up a gear for about 15 or 20 minutes in the second half when it really counted.
It was the fact, I think, that Leeds didn't score in the first half when they were so heavily on top, and there were some kind of old familiar issues there, particularly out wide, where they had a lot of good positions and a lot of positions to do some damage from, which they didn't take advantage of. And, you know, Bamford felt quite peripheral in the game. He didn't touch the ball a huge amount. He didn't put too many passes together. But actually, I went back through the highlights of the game and the footage of the game, and there were periods in it where he took up some great positions in the box, got himself into space, just looking for a nice cross onto his head in the way that Harrison was able to serve it up at Sheffield United. And it was just never there at any point. You know, the stages of the game where Leeds looked like they could have got ahead, they should have gone ahead, they just didn't have that precision where it mattered. And I think you're right, there was a definite swing at the start of the second half. There was a definite upturn in Wolves' confidence, and they know that from front to back they've got quality in most positions and players who are good enough to decide a tight game like that. And I think, as difficult a game as it was, I think they'll look at that as a kind of routine away win, where you have to defend very well, you have to be tight, and ultimately when the odd chance or two comes, you've got to take one of them, which is exactly what they did.
But ultimately what decided it was a stroke of luck, more or less, wasn't it? It still is one that could have gone either way. I think despite the fact Wolves came into it more in the second half, it was not so much that they carved us open as Calvin just dangled his head at something.
Yeah, it was a good game without being high on chances, but I did feel that at the point where the goal arrived, it seemed to have been coming for a little while. Certainly when Saez banged in that volley that was disallowed, you felt that Wolves were on top at that point and had got the measure of Leeds slightly, and it kind of carried on. And I'd said on Twitter after about 65 minutes that it felt like a scenario for Hernandez, because they did seem to have lost their grip in midfield, and it just felt as if somebody that could put a bit of add a bit of cam there, put their foot on the ball a bit more, would have helped. And he came on right after Jimenez scored with that deflection off Phillips, and it felt like it came a little bit too late, because you knew what Wolves would do, and you knew that in their system, and particularly with Cody in the middle of defence, who was always smart enough to be in open play a yard behind Bamford, never to give Bamford the run on him, never to let him in behind and have the chance of any one-on-ones. You knew in that system it was going to be very difficult to create anything great. But you're right, it was. I think fine margins was absolutely right. I can imagine Wolves thinking that they'd done just about enough to earn that result. I can well imagine Leeds thinking, as I think they do, that they deserved a point from it. But I think it just was that little moment that went their way, just at the same time as accepting that I think it did feel as if it was possibly in the post.
I'm sure Bielsa would shoulder the responsibility for not making the subs a little bit earlier, but I agree. It felt to me in that second half, you were sort of willing him to change it because you could see the game was getting away from us. Do you think he got that wrong?
Yeah, possibly. I think, again, it comes back to the fact, and this, as we'll talk about, is more of a problem now that Calvin Phillips is injured. It comes back to the fact that there isn't a huge amount of choice when it comes to central midfielders, and particularly after them failing to sign Michael Cuisance in the window. That is the area where they do look a little bit short, but it did just seem as if it needed a bit of an older head or a bit of a calmer head or somebody to add the body in there. And the thing about Hernandez is that we focus a lot on, you know, what he does in a creative sense, his assists and his goals and everything else. But he is good at dictating play, and he is good at setting the rhythm. And I think crucially at changing the rhythm when that needs to happen. And I agree with you. It felt around about the hour as if Wolves had just managed to get their foot into that game, and as if Leeds were going backwards slightly. And I wonder with hindsight whether Bielsa wishes he'd made that change earlier. But I think even though the game swung after Hernandez came on and Leeds had most of it from there until the end, it seemed to me that Wolves were happy for it to play out that way. And the fact that they got the goal meant that they, you know, they knew how to sit back, they knew how to dig in, and they knew how to see that out. And as I say, you look at them and without them being sparkling on Monday night, they do seem very accomplished.
What did you make of Rafinha's debut?
Good, I thought. In the little period that he was on, certainly a couple of little runs and crosses that seemed promising, plenty of pace there. I think in a game like that on Monday, Bielsa's wingers have got to kill it, because you won't get any ball through the middle. If you watch the periods of the game at which Leeds were trying to play through Rodrigo and into Bamford and Harrison dropping into central area to try and get through the middle of Wolves' defence, it was too congested and too compact, and you would have scenarios where Wolves would have 6, 7, 8 players around them leaving no space. But out wide, Leeds had quite a bit of joy, and you know, it was the kind of precision of the deliveries from the wings that was letting them down. And you know, that I think is the bonus for Bielsa, is that he does have Poveda as an alternative. He does have Rafinha, who looked to me just in that short spell like a talented player with plenty about him. And when they find themselves on a night or on a day where they have players camped behind the ball and they're almost back to that championship scenario of the bus parked in front of the goal, it's got to work out wide. And if it doesn't work out wide, you're susceptible to the sort of result that came on Monday night. But I still think in the main, it's positive to say that they've gone toe-to-toe with a Europa League team and have genuinely made them grind it out at Elland Road.
And we are going to lose the odd game like this. That's something we're going to have to face up to in the Premier League, because there are some really quality teams in this league. I mean, like, you know, we could have shaded maybe a draw against Liverpool, maybe got something against Man City, but all games so far have been pretty close, really, haven't they? So we've got to, I guess, just take these on the chin.
Yeah, and I think until the league reaches a point where it settles down and teams start to know properly what it is that they're looking at, so whether they're going to be trying to stay up or whether they're going to be comfortably mid-table or aiming a little higher than that, you're not quite sure what these results mean. So you don't know if at the end of the season you're going to look back at this kind of defeat and think that a point there would have been very helpful and might have made a big difference. Whereas in the Championship, it was hard to rationalise any poor result because of what Leeds were aiming for and because the margin for error was so small when it came to finishing in the top two. You could never come away from Elland Road having dropped points without feeling anything other than frustration about it. And I don't doubt that that'll have been the same on Monday, especially because the game was so finely balanced. But it is that change of mindset, isn't it, from a league like the Championship that you're desperate to get out of to a league like the Premier League that you're happy to be in. And I don't think anybody ever acclimatises to the feeling of getting beaten. And I don't think, you know, once you get further into a Premier League season, you're as able to be as kind of philosophical about it as you are before a ball's been kicked and you're enjoying the feeling of being back at that level. But this is going to happen, and you know it will happen more often than not in the Premier League, because that's the way it is. And I think, as I said it right at the beginning, you don't get away with as much as at this level. And that's probably the biggest lesson from the game against Wolves.
Jimenez ended up being the central antagonist, I guess, in this particular narrative. I mean, we spoke about him earlier in the week on the Square Ball podcast, and perhaps I think I was guilty of letting him off a little bit in regards to the kick out against Robin Koch. And now we've seen the shove on Calvin Phillips has cost us Phillips for 6 weeks. And of course he was, well, he scored a goal, but it was with the assistance of Phillips' head. So talk to me about Jimenez.
I would let him away with the foul on Phillips. Clipped his heel, nudged him, but I don't think there was any intent there. I don't mean there wasn't any intent to foul him, but whereas if you look at Pickford's foul on Van Dijk on Saturday, you could see from a mile off that there was quite a grave risk there of somebody coming away with a broken leg or an ACL, as it turned out. The Jimenez challenge on Phillips was felt more innocuous to me, and it's just unlucky that Phillips has landed on his shoulder in that way. And I think even Phillips will probably be surprised that in those circumstances it's resulted in an injury that means that he's going to be out for 5 or 6 weeks. I'm a little bit like, you know, the handball rule. I'm less and less certain about what it is that VAR is looking for, because I didn't think there was any doubt at all that there was a kick out there, and a deliberate one, and an attempt to catch Robin Koch. And if I'm being honest, in the climate at the moment, I think that's a red card. I do. I think it's not horrendous, and you know, at worst, he would have caught Koch with his studs, potentially in that area. But it's violent conduct, isn't it? It's not excessively violent conduct, but it surely crosses the line. And I find it odd that VAR just seemed to ignore that completely. In fact, there are quite a lot of things in games that you expect VAR to look at, and they don't. And it all seems, well, I mean, it, you know, it's criticised every weekend of the season, but it all feels a bit ad hoc, and it all feels a bit out of control in the sense of nobody being sure what it is that VAR is there to do. And clearly it did the job when Saiz scored that volley. You know, Ponce was evidently offside on the other side of the pitch as the ball went over the top. But that from Jimenez, yeah, I thought at the very least it should have been reviewed, and I was surprised that it didn't seem to be.
It had very little impact on the game, but I think you're right, it contributes to the overall feeling at the moment that the VAR is a bit out of control. Like no one is sure exactly how it's being used and who is the judge of whether or not things get looked at properly. Because it felt a bit like with the Costa penalty as well. If that had been given and they'd broken that down frame by frame, they could have probably justified that as a penalty as well, even though I don't particularly want to see things like that given.
No, I'm the same. I don't want that to be a penalty, but then you get to the point where so many other things are being given and so many soft challenges are being penalised that you want to see everybody get a fair crack of the whip. And I agree with you, I don't think that the Jimenez and Koch incident would have changed the game significantly, but it doesn't do anything to raise VAR's popularity. And it reminds me a little bit of the game at Arsenal in the FA Cup last season, when I think it was Berardi who had a kick aimed at him, and again, even though that was blatant and even though it was deliberate, VAR just seemed to brush it off and move on, which is clearly their prerogative because they're in the position to judge these things. But it's a little bit difficult for the rest of us to understand.
What you're saying, Phil, is there's an anti-Leeds agenda for definite.
Oh, absolutely.
With regards to the Merseyside derby, one of the things we picked up on in the Square Ball podcast was that the ref from Monday night, David Coote, was the VAR referee, actually, in the Everton-Liverpool game. What sort of a game do you think he had on Monday?
I didn't think he was terrible. I thought... I think it helped Wolves that the flow of the game was a bit disjointed, and I think that did help to take a bit of the sting out of the way Leeds were playing, although equally I thought Leeds flagged at that crucial period and at the start of the second half where you were really looking for them to turn the screw. And I think that was the point in the game where if they'd been able to sustain the performance and score in that period, then the first half would have looked like a good build-up to decisive point in the match. As it was, the first half was made to look like a period in which they desperately needed to score, and because they didn't, it came to bear on them. So I don't think Coote was responsible for the result. And if anything, on Monday, I think there was more to be said about the video referee than there was about him, because of the challenge on Costa and because of the incident between Jimenez and Koch. But yeah, I thought it was passable, his performance.
I'm surprised they didn't ask him to take a second look, actually, at Jimenez and the kick out at Koch, but there we are. Injuries mounting up. Now, we're going to hear from Bielsa. We're recording the first half of this show just before Bielsa's press conference ahead of Villa. So we'll have his reaction and the latest state of play on injuries towards the back end of this show when we preview Villa. But the injuries are mounting up, and we lost Cooper in the warm-up for this game. And you picked out, actually, Strike as your one to watch on last week's show. If Cooper wasn't fit, and it was obviously a very 11 and a half hour injury had a change to the starting lineup. How do you think he did then?
I thought he played well again. And I think that the crucial thing with Struyck is that he's not looking out of his depth at all. Again, like everybody else, it became difficult in the second half. And he was obviously involved in the lead up to the goal, losing his footing. But even after that, there was ample opportunity to kind of shut Jimenez out as he ran across the edge of the box. And I don't think that really falls to Struyck as being his fault. You're certainly right about the injuries, though. I mean, the one with Cooper was less severe than the groin strain that Llorente brought back from international duty with Spain. And I think all last week there was a feeling that Cooper probably would be okay to play against Wolves. But we were watching him in the warm-up and they were doing a little bit of possession, six players against six, and knocking the ball around in a square. And you could see him speaking to one of the physios, signalling towards his groin. You could see when he was running that he wasn't entirely comfortable, and it became pretty obvious that he was going to have to make way. And I think that leaves quite a bit of doubt over whether or not he's going to be able to play at Villa on Friday. We'll find out shortly from Bielsa, but I would suspect not. I think it would be difficult to turn around from that on Monday night and be ready for a Friday evening game, and Llorente won't be fit either. But obviously the key injury is that to Phillips, and that is always the key injury for Leeds, because a little bit like Van Dijk over at Liverpool, when Phillips is missing, the question of who replaces him is probably the most difficult one to answer in Bielsa's squad.
So all in all then, conclusion on Monday, we just write this one off and crack on with the next one?
I think so. I think the thing they need to be careful of now, especially because the injuries are kicking in, is that one defeat to Wolves doesn't become another defeat to Villa and then become a third defeat to a very good Leicester side a little bit further down the line. I think it would help everybody to take something from the Villa game just to feel like that impetus is still there. But yeah, I wouldn't be dwelling to any great extent on the game on Monday. I just think the lessons about what went wrong were fairly obvious. It did weaken in midfield. There was a fair amount of wastage out wide. I think if they'd been more consistent in either of those positions over 90 minutes, they'd have taken something from that game and they'd potentially have won it.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Now, this is a beauty then, Phil. As part of The Athletic marking Black History Month, you spoke to Cesc Pod about his experiences in football and the work that he did at Leeds to help turn the tide away from what was quite a dark time in the 80s with problems of racism and the National Front being active outside the stadium. So tell us a bit about that. What was it like to speak to him?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is the whole point of the Black History Month features, is that the fact that it's easy now to forget exactly what it was like back then. And actually, it's easy to not know what it was like back then, because Pod grew up in the 60s in Leeds. He'd come over from the Caribbean with his family. He had five siblings and his mother and father thought there'd be better educational opportunities for them over here. And I mean, you said to me when I told you that we were doing this piece, you said, well, look out for the inevitable What About White History Month tweets that come your way. And it's true, and that does happen. But it's when you listen to or read a story like Pod's that you properly understand what it is like to not only to be in an industry like football, which was horrendously racist back in the 70s and 80s when he was playing, but also to grow up in England, in northern English city, same all over the country, really, in the 1960s, when it was incredibly difficult to be a black kid on the streets. And, you know, when we first started talking about him coming over to England, he spoke about how the family grew up in Beeston. And the story that jumped out to me was him saying that he had two ways of getting to school in the morning. He could either take the bus, which was, in his words, the safe way, but it cost money. And if he wanted to save his pocket money, the other option was to walk. But in order to walk, he had to go through a nearby gypsy camp. And he said that without fail, every day, he would have to run through the camp. And if they caught up with him, he'd be in a fight. You know, there'd be no question about it. And as you went through his younger life and the trials that he was offered that came to nothing in his opinion now because of racial profiling. And then on to Bradford, where he became record appearance maker and obviously made his name in the game, and heard the stories about the racism he encountered there. Not from the club. I mean, I've got to say, Bradford sounded incredibly supportive of him. But, you know, at opposition away grounds where he was abused, he remembers being someone spitting in his face. The fact that it was, the atmosphere was so bad that his mother went to one game and then refused to go back and said to him, I don't know why you play this game, because they don't like you. The people who are watching you play don't like you. And he said she found it very difficult to differentiate between Bradford supporters who were very supportive of him and the opposition crowds who abused him constantly. And all in all, it was such a sad tale. But in speaking to him, I was amazed by how positive he was about it and really how little he seemed to hold a grudge about what had gone on. Because I have to be honest, I can't imagine living through anything like that.
I mean, I remember growing up going in the 80s, and I think it's a really important part of our history that we need to understand where we've come from and the progress that we've made. And there's probably still work to do as well on that front, particularly with the way that society is at the moment. But yeah, I remember chants on the cop. I remember bananas being thrown at grounds, and people wouldn't believe that who maybe got into football in like the 90s or the 2000s or more recently, that is what it was like. And it's important that I think we have a look at these things so we can understand how we can keep improving.
I think it shows how things can change as well, because by the time I came to games mid-90s, that was all gone. You'd hear odd, you still would and still do, to be fair, still hear odd isolated people shouting things that kind of make you turn your head a little bit. But that side of it had completely gone. And it showed how that changed in such a short space of time. And I think with the almost the recent upswing of nationalism and racism across the country, I think it's a thing to almost keep an eye on now to make sure it doesn't flip back the other way.
There's probably no more infamous example of racism in the 80s than Mark Walters at Hearts getting bananas thrown at him. And obviously, they're my club, and it is still an absolute embarrassment that when you watch it back. But you saying that you noticed the difference in the 90s, or at least didn't notice the same kind of culture, is interesting, because that was in part down to Pod coming to Leeds at the end of the 80s. He'd finished playing, he'd gone and he'd had a bit of time with Scarborough and also with Ossett Town, and he was approached by the PFA and told that Leeds wanted a football in the community officer. They wanted somebody. They were well aware of the fact that there were problems with racism at Elland Road, and that they had the National Front on the streets on match days, and they wanted to become more inclusive, and they wanted to reach out to the city, and they basically wanted to make it feel like a safe place for black or ethnic minority supporters to come to. So the PFA put Pod's name forward, and he tells a story of the interview and that he had for the job, and even there, of somebody who, to his credit, I think he didn't want to name, he didn't want to sort of settle old scores, but somebody at Leeds who invented false allegations about him to try and stop him getting the job, about things that had gone on at a couple of the development centres that Pod worked at, the fact that they hadn't been successful, or the suggestion that money had gone missing. And the PFA investigated all this and none of it was true. And as Pod says, there can have been no reason for that other than the person concerned was racist or he didn't like Pod. And given that they'd never met before, as Pod says, it could only be the same thing. And I think as you go through these stories, you start to realise what it is actually like to be at risk of discrimination pretty much every day and in any environment that you go into. And given the work that he did for the club and given the difference that he helped to make, I thought that was probably the most shocking part of the entire story.
And he did do some sterling work in the communities. I mean, anyone who's familiar with the geography of Leeds will understand we've got Chapel Town as a large black area. And it was so important for him to go out into those areas and engage these kids and try and get them into football. Because for a long time, particularly during the 80s, Leeds didn't engage those communities. And it's such a rich part of the city.
I think they were aware of that as well. And it's important to say that he felt that he got a huge amount of support from Howard Wilkinson, who would constantly put players up, you know, for a lot of times to go down into Chapel Town and other areas to speak to the kids and play a bit of football and try and engage with them and embrace them. He said he got a lot of support from Alan Roberts, who was the general manager at the time, and also from Leslie Silver and Bill Fotherby. He said it was extremely strategic and it was a really concerted effort to change things. And he's absolutely convinced that he did and that they did. And it wasn't a case of it becoming perfect overnight. And it wasn't a case of going from severe racism in the late 1980s to none at all at the start of the 1990s. But he said he was very much aware of black supporters starting to appear at games and of people being more interested. And I think it's, for me anyway, I've heard Pod spoken about before and I knew a little bit about his community role, but I wanted to find out about it properly because I had a feeling that there was probably far more to it than he ever let on. And it came up in conversation that in the end, he'd dealt with Albert Johansson in his final years before Johansson died. Johansson had been a big hero of his because when Pob was growing up in Beeston, Johansson was playing for Leeds. And he said it was really the only reason I went to watch the club was because there was a black face amongst the white players on the pitch. You know, there was a black player there and it was something to latch onto, something to feel connected about. And, you know, there was no support for Johansson, really. The club tried to give him a bit of financial help, but he was destitute. He was obviously suffering from alcoholism and he had a lot of problems. And I thought Pod was right about one thing. He said things have changed and support networks are much better. But when you think now about the small number of black former players who go into coaching or management, you're still left with the question of what is there for them when the game finishes? You know, what is out there to occupy them or to earn the money or to keep them busy? And the answer is probably not an awful lot. And it does make you think that, you know, the support that was kind of needed back when Johansson was at his lowest ebb is probably still needed in the same way now.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
We're joined now by Jermaine Beckford. Thank you so much for joining us. You're doing a Leeds podcast at the minute with Matthew Lewis, and people should check that out. Doing a Leeds. You will find that in your podcast player right now. So can you tell us then, Jermaine, about life as a black footballer at Leeds?
You know what? Life as a black footballer in general always has its challenges. You know, we'd like to think that it's all fair and all even and there's no discrimination that goes on. But to a certain extent, there is, unfortunately. And, you know, it's something that fortunately for black football players and black people in general, nowadays, this new generation of footballers that are coming through are not, they're not shy and they're not afraid to put their thoughts and their views out there, and they use their platforms really, really well. And it's something that they should all be very, very proud of.
I think, Jimmy, we all like to think that things have moved on and things are different now or in some ways potentially easier. But some of the stuff that Cess Pob was talking about, I found really shocking. Can you relate to that or does it shock you to read that as well, given the way things are in society these days?
Yes and no. It does shock me because of the times that we live in now, it doesn't happen that often. It still happens, but it doesn't happen that often. But to hear that it used to happen every single football match and walking down the street, you'd be worried or concerned about being attacked, verbally or physically attacked. And one of the stories that really stuck with me is his journey to school. He had two different ways to get to school. He had the safe journey, which was on the bus, and the not-so-safe journey, shall we call it. We've come a long way and the world has moved on quite a distance since then. But as I mentioned, we've still got a little bit of distance to go.
You had a bit of a thorny relationship, actually, with the Leeds crowd in general when you were there during the promotion season. Although it's nice that there's a lot of mutual love there, looking back on it. Can you tell us what that was like at the time when you were trying to get Leeds promoted, but you were getting a little bit of stick from the crowd?
Yeah, I was getting a little bit of stick, but that's because I had a transfer request put in and the details of that were a little bit sticky. And understandably, the Leeds fans weren't privy to all the details, et cetera, of that. And, you know, as quickly as I made the decision with the people around me, I made the decision to pull it back because it's not the way that I wanted to be remembered. And I like to think a lot of the Leeds fans have appreciated my honesty, first and foremost, but the work that I put into the club to help them get back into a position where they deserve to be. You know, my only regret from my time at Leeds is that I didn't stay there for longer. I wanted to end my career there. And it's a phenomenal football club with an amazing fan base. And I've made no secret of the fact that I am a Leeds fan and I couldn't help but become a Leeds fan, you know, after that first week of joining up at Four Parch and going for a stroll through the Leeds city centre and having my first encounter with a Leeds fan who was maybe four or five times my age. And he was screaming at me, "You're my idol, you're my hero, you're going to be someone special. Just get your head down, work hard, score goals, and we'll love you forever for it." And something that I tried to do as much as I could. There were times where I preserved a little bit of energy, shall we say, instead of running into the channels. I was saving my energy and waiting for the moments where it counted in front of goal. But I don't think that was fully appreciated at the time.
I interviewed you way back when I started on The Athletic, and there were two things that were, well, there was loads in it that was really interesting, but two things that jumped out. Firstly, the story of the car you drive, which is the equivalent of Top Gear's reasonably priced car. But secondly, when you're talking about the crowd, you were saying that when you first joined Leeds, you found the experience of playing in front of 30,000 really strange and really difficult. And I remember you saying there were times when you were thinking it wasn't going well, and you were thinking with other players around about you, just don't pass the ball to me for 5 minutes so I can get myself going and just kind of reset a little bit. It was a big culture shock for you coming from Wealdstone.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Like, when you take into account, I was playing in front of 80 people on a Saturday, and then all of a sudden I'm thrown into the lion's pit that is Elland Road, you know, in front of 34,500 people within the space of a handful of days. My first touch when I came off the bench against Crystal Palace was a bad touch, but it was a good touch. So I meant to control it and keep it to my feet, but it ended up bouncing up over the defender's head. And I ended up spinning. The defender went the wrong way. I went the right way. He dragged me down. I got away with one there. But everybody laughed it. They loved it. They cheered. And, you know, from there, I think it was the next game, I had like you mentioned, a brief 5 minute spell or 4 or 5 minute spell where everything I tried to do, nothing came off. And I could feel the tension rising every time the ball was coming up to me, but it kept on coming up. And I was just looking at the players thinking, please just bear with me, understand the situation that I'm in. I'm up against it here. Just give me a couple of minutes. Let me just get myself together. And then, you know, you'll start seeing the best of me. They didn't do that. They kept on popping the ball to my feet, popping it to my chest, putting it in the air. And I had to try and figure it out. And fortunately for me, being thrown in the deep end gave me thicker skin. It gave me the opportunity to understand that there's a lot more to playing for Leeds United than just scoring goals.
And what about this car then? Because you're all limos and Ferraris, aren't you?
Get out of here, limos and Ferraris. That would be nice. I drive a hybrid, mate. What are you talking about? When I first turned up at Leeds, I was in a... I'll take you back a little bit further. So I used to work for RAC, and I was driving around in Renault 19s, and I had a Vauxhall Nova. That was my first car, and I absolutely loved it. They were bangers. Like, Nova cost me about 150 quid. The Renault cost me 200 quid, 220 quid, something really random, and a full tank of fuel. So I was buzzing with that. And then I turned up to Thorpe Arch training ground. I made the drive up from London all the way up to Thorpe Arch in my grey Renault Megane. I had 3 hubcaps. One of them was missing. I had a massive dent in the bumper, the rear bumper. There were scratches and scrapes all over it. And I pulled up, and I'm in the car park. I'm still sitting in my car, and I'm looking at the cars that I'm next to. I'm seeing a Ferrari. I'm seeing an Aston Martin. I'm seeing Range Rovers. I'm seeing Mercedes and BMWs. And I'm in this battered little Renault Megane, like, 8, 9 years old, and all the boys are looking at me thinking, please, just whatever you do, don't park your car next to mine. I don't want to run the risk of getting a scratch off that piece of nonsense. So it was fun. It was funny. It didn't last long, though, unfortunately. I miss it.
You seem as if you've become a Leeds fan over the years. And I know that you've said, despite the move to Everton and to Leicester and whatever was in those moves for you, that you would rather, with hindsight, or your preferred option would have been to finish your career at Leeds. What is it about the club, you think, that makes people who, you know, like you, had no prior connection to Leeds before you joined, what is it that makes you develop that connection in the way that you have?
Oh, it was the way I was welcomed in. Like, you'd have good games, you'd have bad games, but the Leeds fans stuck with you through thick and thin. And unfortunately for the club, but possibly fortunately for myself, the time when I came in, we were on track to make it into the Premier League. We got to the playoff final of the Championship, played against Watford, unfortunately lost 3-0. But then from that moment onwards, it was a steady decline, which I was protected from, if I'm honest. Dennis Wise and Gus Poyet, they were in there and they protected me from it. They said, look, we're trying to create something amazing here. you know, we're trying to start something new. We're trying to be fresh in our approach. But I can't have you, I guess, not so much being poisoned by it, but being that there was a lot of players there at the time who were stuck in their ways, I guess. And the club and the manager were trying to get rid of those players to bring in a new era of football player, a new generation, I guess, so to speak. And he didn't want me to be a part of that because it was obviously going to end up getting messy. You know, there's no two ways about the outlook of it. It was going to get messy. And he just wanted me to stay fresh, to stay prepared and to stay focused. So I had a couple of loan spells out. I think the first one was to Carlisle. I played 3 or 4 games, scored my first professional goal. But overall, it wasn't a great move for myself because there were a lot of discrepancies between myself and the club. It didn't quite work out, unfortunately. But they got a lot of really lovely guys there and guys that I got on really well with for many years after that. Then I had a second spell at Scunthorpe. And that for me was better because I was going into a team where there were less pressure. There weren't as much pressure on getting relegated. It was more about getting promoted. Mm-hmm. And they were doing really well. They had Billy Sharp there. They had Andy Keogh and all these boys. They were doing really, really well. They were flying high, as I mentioned, pushing for promotion. So to go into a team where there's no pressure and it's a real togetherness and they can see the goal in sight made my transition to play for those guys for the 6-7 months that I was there really, really easy. And I got a taste of playing professional football, like starting and finishing games. Whereas the season prior, I was coming off the bench for you know, 15 minutes here, 10 minutes there, 20 minutes if I'm lucky. And it's really difficult to kind of get in the swing of things from that perspective. But Nigel Adkins was the manager at the time, and he showed his faith in Billy Sharp and myself, and we just had such a great time. I had the freedom to do as I pleased almost when I was on the pitch. You know, I didn't have to stay up front and be the typical number 9 that you expect. You know, I had the freedom to drift out to the wings, which, if I'm being honest, is one of my preferred positions, you know, up front on the left or the right of a 3. I had that freedom to do that, and I scored a couple of really good goals, exciting goals, and that really, really helped me out moving forwards and coming back to Leeds that following season. But as I mentioned before, it wasn't a great time for the club. So while Leeds were in a transitional period, there were players getting moved left and right, and there were disagreements and arguments that were happening. And unfortunately, the club ended up getting relegated from the Championship to League One, which was an absolute nightmare of a scenario for the club, but obviously for myself as well, because I wanted to prove a point. You know, I'm in League One at the moment with Scunthorpe and I'm doing really well and I'm comfortable there. And I don't really feel like I was being tested as much. If that, it sounds bizarre, but I felt like I could do it. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't really that much of a problem for myself. So I was looking forward to conquering, so to speak, the League One and then really testing myself out in the Championship against much better, much stronger and physical opposition. Unfortunately, as I mentioned before, the club went down, which was devastating for the club. But again, I guess on a personal level, it worked out really well because I'm coming back to a club that I've got such an affiliation with all of a sudden, 6-12 months later. And I'm playing in a league that I now understand and I get it. So it worked out for me personally really well because I got to be the number 1, number 9. And Dennis Wise and Gus Poyet were still there, and you know, they had a few more grey hairs, if I'm honest, when I saw them the next time. But as they both promised me and they both explained to me when I went out on loan initially, look, we're gonna start focusing and building a team around yourself. And we've got these plans and those plans, and we think you're going to be an integral part of it. And that, for me, was a very exciting moment.
You were talking about your playing style there, Jermaine. I'm interested to know, because you said you like to, should we say, conserve your energy at certain moments. How do you think you would have fared in a Bielsa side?
Oh, I'd have been fine. Now, I'd have done a lot of training, wouldn't I? honestly, this current crop of boys are so fit. It's amazing. Honestly, they if you look at the work rate that they put in, as soon as they lose the ball in the final third, when they're on an attack, they lose the ball. Every single one of them sprints as fast as they can, as hard as they can, to get back behind the ball at any given opportunity. And the Wolves game is a perfect example. Every Leeds United player covered on average 5K more than the Wolves team or something along those lines. The stats were incredible. But it's for moments like that and reasons like that why they are doing so well. So the result wasn't ideal, but if you look at the way the game was played and the game plan and the mindset of all the players, I don't think they could have done anything more apart from being a little bit more ruthless in the final third.
Do you think that players now understand the intricacies of tactics more than even, say, 10 years ago when you were winning promotion with the club? Do you think players are more skilled in it these days and I guess more educated in the sort of massive complexity of tactics that you see with somebody like Bielsa?
Absolutely, absolutely. It's the nutritional side as well that kicks in, and that plays a massive part, because 10, 12, 14 years ago when I was playing, when I first started playing for Leeds, it was there, but it wasn't there as an integral part of becoming a better player. You know, it was just to stop you going out and having a couple of beers or having some cigarettes or whatever after the games, which was an old school mentality. The whole generation of the tactics, the physical aspect of it, the work rate, the nutritional side, massively benefited the English game, let alone just us, you know. And I think with the influx of foreign managers that we had come through 10, 12, 14 years ago, I think that was a key part of it. We had a lot of Italian managers and Spanish managers, and the way they approached the game in terms of what they would bring to pre-match meals, instead of having burgers and chips, they would bring brown pasta and some sort of brown rice or something along those lines. You know, it's a lot more healthy options. A lot of clubs cut out things like tomato ketchup and mayonnaise and replaced it with olive oils. It sounds silly, it sounds trivial, but in the bigger picture, if you're having these things ordered every single day, it's naturally going to take its toll on you. Definitely the new generation, the new era of players appreciate and respect it because they can see first and foremost, firsthand, the difference in players. Like if you look at body shapes, for example, Wayne Rooney and Cristiano Ronaldo, they're very similar in age. Cristiano Ronaldo, the way he eats and the way he trains is completely different to the way Wayne Rooney does, you know, and you can tell physically firsthand. And Ronaldo is up there with rubbing shoulders with Leo Messi, and they've been splitting opinion for the last decade over who's the best in the world, not just in the country or in the league, in the world. Wayne Rooney, in my opinion, had the ability to be up there rubbing shoulders with them, but maybe his level of determination or commitment wasn't as high as those two. So to be able to see those sort of idols firsthand and see the results right in front of you, you know, I think that definitely does prove a point.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Phil, you've just been in on Marcelo Bielsa's press conference, and I'd like to get Jermaine's thoughts on the upcoming game against Villa on Friday. So how is Marcelo today? This is all fresh, hot off the press news for us here.
It is about half an hour ago. He was asked about Calvin Phillips, who's obviously injured his shoulder. He was saying that the kind of estimated time frame of 6 weeks out is pretty loose. So it could be shorter than that. It could be longer. I think at the moment they're not entirely clear, but he has avoided surgery, which I think is quite a relief for the club. I think it was fairly borderline whether he might need some surgery. Pascal Struijk is going to play in defensive midfield at Villa. He'll take the number four role. But there is still a doubt over Liam Cooper, who obviously had the groin strain in the warm-up against Wolves. And no Diego Llorente either. He won't be fit. So there is going to have to be some reshuffling at the back if Cooper doesn't make it. And I think it's probably quite doubtful that he will. But you know how Bielsa is with these things. He's always fairly relaxed when he has to shuffle the team. He's always fairly relaxed when it comes to finding solutions. He seems to prefer to find solutions rather than worry about problems. And it's been that way for as long as he's been head coach. And he's been in positions previously where he's been short of players or he's looked like he's lacking numbers in key areas. So the same as ever, really. I don't think he'll be unduly concerned, but I do feel always that Phillips is a very, very big miss on the basis that there just isn't a like-for-like replacement for him or not a proven one.
What impact do you think that's going to have on Friday, Jermaine?
I think it will naturally have an impact. You know, he's definitely one of those players that would have caused an issue to Jack Grealish, who seems to be his new BFF now that he's by himself. But I think it's definitely going to be a tricky position to fill, a tricky void to fill, because Strake is good. Don't get me wrong. He's becoming a little bit of a utility player now. He's filling in that centre half. He's filling in that holding midfield role. It's a position that is pivotal to the way we play the game. Pretty much everything either goes through Calvin or he stops. He breaks everything up, the opposition play. So, and not to mention his distribution. His distribution is brilliant. Mm. You know, I think that's something that gets overlooked as well. So I think we're definitely going to have to reshuffle the pack. But it's a problem that we don't have to worry about. We've got the best manager in the land.
There's a lot of menace in that Villa team as well, isn't there? In the area where Phillips would have been playing, you've got Barkley at 10, you've got Grealish on the left, but Grealish can roam a bit and cause a lot of bother. And they, I mean, they've started as well as any other team. They look like their recruitment in the summer has made a huge difference to what was a fairly bang average Premier League side last season, and actually pretty lucky to get away with relegation in the end.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, they avoided it. I think it was by one goal, didn't they, on the final day of the season. So anything for them this season was going to be a bonus. As you mentioned, their summer window has actually been really good. They've also got Ollie Watkins, another player that we were linked heavily with as well, somebody that I'd spoken to over the summer. And he was on the cusp of joining the club, but for one reason or another, his move broke down and fell through, which was a shame, if I'm honest with you, because he's not only a really good football player and a great goal scorer, but he's a lovely person as well. He would have worked out well for us. But, you know, they are four games in the Premier League season, four wins from four, the best record in the Premier League at the moment, unbeaten. But I think if you're a Villa fan, you should be getting excited. Absolutely, 100%, because it's, you know, it's a vast improvement on how they played last season. But in the grand scheme of things, the larger picture, getting too excited too early is always a dangerous subject, and it's always a dangerous to do. You know, I think taking it game by game is absolutely the key for it. Approaching every game as if it's your last, which is what we're doing. We approach every game in such a positive mindset. Nobody really knows how to deal with us or combat us. You know, Wolverhampton Wanderers, the last two seasons have finished, what, seventh in the league, in the Premier League, both seasons. And they didn't know how to deal with us. You know, they had to sit back for 70 minutes, 75 minutes or whatnot, and then got a very, very fortunate goal. But that's exactly what we need to do. We need to understand how to break teams down. And as I mentioned earlier, just the final third, we need to be a little bit more clinical. But that aside, I think we should have enough to deal with the threat of Aston Villa, even without Calvin in there. But the issue then becomes filling in at centre half. Who we're gonna get to prop up there?
I was just going to finish with one last question, Jermaine, if we can. Tell people what, as you told me, what always goes through your head every time you walk back into Elland Road. What is it that you remember, and what is it that you were saying when I interviewed you way back that you still feel every time?
Apart from goosebumps. I absolutely love it. Listen, it's such a... Elland Road is an arena. It's somewhere that only gladiators should be a part of. It's amazing. And do you know what? I find a shame, and I'm drifting away from your question here a little bit, if I'm honest with you. I find it's not only for us Leeds fans, but for all football fans, we're not able to experience what it's like in the Premier League firsthand from the stadiums, especially when you see that there are opera houses that are, they're closed roofs, but they're still able to hold 3,000 fans or whatnot. And the football stadiums and all that sort of stuff is 10,000, 15,000, 20,000 plus capacity, open air. And we're not able to safely find a way for fans to enjoy the games. You know, I would love to be a player playing in this team right now in the Premier League for Leeds United and have the fans there. Because walking into the stadium and then walking through the tunnel, the energy you get from it, the adrenaline you pick up from it, the fun and the excitement that you get. And then, as I mentioned before, the goosebumps when you're walking out of the stadium to hear the roar of the fans and to know that they're 100% behind you. It's a shame. And it is a little bit, there's a part of it that really doesn't sit right with me. And it's something that I really, really hope that we're able to rectify very soon.
You always say, though, that every time you go back in, you can feel that goal, that promotion goal. You can still feel it, and you can still kind of remember that little moment of silence as it flew in.
Do you know what? And you know when, so the goalkeeper's tried to throw it out over my head and I've flicked it. It's gone to Brad Johnson and he's tried to shoot or cross, as he said. And you know, touching on that moment just before when the ball falls to me, the split second before I actually make contact with it, where I'm having like 17 different thoughts going through my head. Do I put it over him? Do I put it under him? Do I put it around him? Do I take a touch? What's going to happen if I lace it, if I hit it with my laces? That split second, it was one of the most peaceful moments, because I kind of knew it before I did anything what I was going to do. But as soon as I made that connection, as you mentioned there, the ball's gone underneath the goalkeeper. And before it's hit the net, it was almost like a dead silence. There was nothing there. There was no sound. I couldn't hear the wind. I couldn't hear anything. And it was just like the perfect silence. And as soon as it hit the net, that eruption, that explosion of sound was just phenomenal. And it scared the life out of me, but it excited me so, so much. It was amazing. Absolutely.
I'm just wondering, do you miss that, Jermaine, that adrenaline rush? Because a lot of players, when they finish playing, they struggle with the transition into being normal in real life. I mean, it must be a huge thrill to be a footballer, but then to have that come to an end one day, how do you deal with that?
For me, it was difficult initially because it wasn't my choice. It wasn't my choice to retire. I wish it was. I wish I got to a point in my career where I said to myself, right, I'm waking up every morning, I'm aching, my body's aching. You know, enough's enough. I've had enough. I'm not in love with the game anymore. But that wasn't the case. Unfortunately, had 3 major knee operations in 4 years, and that kind of made the decision for me. The surgeon, who amazing as he was, said to me, "Listen, you can try and come back from this injury. It's not a problem, but risk of doing it again. But if you do it again, then we're going to have to give you a full knee replacement." You know, and that's not something that I'd envisaged for myself before the age of 40, at least. That's something that wasn't even part of my subconscious, let alone becoming a stark reality. So fortunately for myself and my missus helped me out. We ended up, once I did my knee the first or second time, we ended up starting up a vegan wellness company called Supernova. And that, alongside a lot of the media duties that I've been doing on Sky Sports, BBC and TalkSport, etc., helped me to deal with the fact that I wasn't going to be playing anymore, but it also gave me a newfound love and appreciation for life outside of football. Having started playing professional when I was 22 anyway, I kind of understood what the real world was like outside of the football bubble, so to speak. And I've gone from living on £700 a month, £800 a month, so to go back to something like that wouldn't have been an issue if that had been the case. But fortunately, I'm doing pretty well with what I'm doing. And, you know, I've got a newfound focus and a newfound love for football, for vegan wellness, and for commentating as well. So I'm really enjoying life.
Perfect. Thank you so much for joining us, Jermaine. We really appreciate you coming on the show.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Right, Phil, one to watch. Aston Villa, Friday. What are we looking out for? Your prediction powers?
Well, obviously, it was going to be Grealish against Phillips, England international v England international, but that's not going to happen. So I think the one to watch is going to be Ross Barkley. Wasn't quite good enough, or however you want to put it, to get a game under Neil Warnock at Leeds, but is now looking very, very decent for Villa in the Premier League. I think Leeds will have to keep Grealish quiet, but I think if they don't do the same to Barkley, he will do them damage. He would be my one to watch.
Well, fingers crossed he does us no damage and we come away with 3 points. Do you fancy us to win this one?
I think it'll be tough, minus Phillips. I do think minus Phillips and given their form, I think it will be difficult. I think a point would be a good result from this.
What about you, Captain Pessimistic?
I'd also take a point. I think Phillips is a big miss, and well, I think Strike is probably good enough to fill in. It's the reshuffle that he necessitates in the back line as well. It just might all throw us out of sync a little bit.
I'm prepared to get egg on my face now for this, but we're going to win this one on Friday.
That's the spirit.
They're due a defeat. They're overdue a defeat. Hey, listen, to catch up with all the stuff on Cess Pod and all Phil's writing over on The Athletic, get yourself signed up right now for just £1 a month. Head to theathletic.com/LeedsPod, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
The Phil Hay Show.